Hello and welcome to Words and Pictures, the comics and animation show. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today I'm joined by the creators of the new Image Comics title, The Humans. Tom Neely and Keenan Marshall Keller are here in the studio. Tom and Keenan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, The Humans, this is a creator-owned series from a big-time publisher, Image Comics. This is a big change from the days when the rights to the Superman franchise were sold for $130. You have all the rights and everything.
Yeah.
An awesome deal that Image does. Yeah, it just lets us do what we want, own what we do.
Right. It sounds like you have a lot of freedom to write and draw whatever crazy ideas come into your head.
So,
tell our listeners how The Humans came to be.
It was basically drunk talk at a bar between me and Tom, where the initial spark started, because I had an idea years ago for a biker gang of ape men running crazy in 70s Bakersfield. And Tom started talking about, because Tom's been self-publishing for years, we both have, and he wanted to try something new.
Yeah, I was reaching a point, I was finishing up my Henry and Glenn Forever and Ever series, and was trying to come up with some ideas for, like, wanting to kind of break out of a little bit out of the indie scene and more into like doing some mainstream books. And I thought I just wanted to draw more. So I started thinking about working with writers, whereas in the past I've been writing my own graphic novels. And so we were just like having beers and talking about comics like we do all the time. And he told me the idea. And as soon as I heard apes on motorcycles, I was like, I went home and started drawing it immediately. It's like, I've always wanted to draw that and I had no idea.
Yeah, you mentioned Henry and Glenn Forever. That's a mini comic you did with your pal Scott and Igloo and local publisher Microcosm here in Portland.
Right. Yeah.
Put that one out. And for people who haven't seen it, it's a pretty wacky little parody of romance comics. And on the back cover, it says, there's a quote from Henry Rollins. It says, has Glenn seen this? Trust me, he would not be impressed.
Yeah. I call it one of the dumbest ideas that ever fell out of a beer bottle and became a runaway hit. But my buddies, I had an art fraternity called the Igloo Tornado for a while. It was me and three other artists, Jen Stevens, Scott Nobles, and Levon Jahanian. And we'd basically just get together and look at each other's artwork and talk about projects and stuff. And one night we were like at a bar doodling on napkins, and Jen Stevens said like, yeah, we should do this. Like, should be like Tom of Finland, but with Henry Rollins and Glenn Danzig.
No.
And I was like, all right, let's just do it. And we started doing it. And then Microcosm picked it up as a book, and that became like this weird cult hit. And so then I did a sequel as a miniseries and opened it up to even more artists, like had like 40 other artists join me to do their own takes on the characters. And that became a book called Henry and Glenn Forever and Ever, which is also published by Microcosm.
I heard that Glenn Danzig didn't necessarily have a sense of humor about it, which is funny because he's been playing silly characters on Portlandia lately.
He doesn't necessarily have a sense of humor, period, but now he's trying to pretend like he has one is what it seems like.
He called me incredibly stupid in Rolling Stone recently.
Yeah.
So, like, that's great. Fine.
Caught. That's
I mean, I love Danzig and his music. I grew up on the Misfits, but... So it's kind of weird to like have your idol hate you, but also he knows who I am, which is kind of fun too.
Well, you're both kind of from the metal punk scene, and you have a background not only with indie comics, but also with music and art. Mm-hmm. So how did Image Comics decide that you guys were the right fit for a title for them?
Well, we had started off, we were going to self-publish The Humans, and we actually did self-publish the first issue, which we called Issue Zero. But when we were in the midst of working on that and putting it together, Eric Stevenson at Image got heard wind of it through our friend Charles Brownstein, and he contacted us and said they were interested, and so it just kind of fell in our lap. We expected to like try to struggle to self-publish it because that's what we've always done.
Yeah, I don't think either of us had an idea or an inkling that they'd even take us seriously until
pitch this to Image? And they're like, nah, they'd never take us.
Yeah, we're just like,
and then they did, so, and it worked out.
And now they can't get rid of us.
So a little background on the series. This is a comic where the dominant species are anthropomorphic apes and humans are pets or slaves. So have you gotten any cease and desist orders from the Planet of the Apes people yet?
Nope. I think we're luckily not touching on anything from those other than just an ape planet, which they're not even, there's been multiple versions of that.
We're not like, doing anything really that similar. It's not really a sci-fi.
It's not sci-fi. Book, so. It's not, you know, we're doing American history just with the
apes.
The dynamic of humans being at the top of the food chain, flipping, and having apes being the hierarchy species.
So. Right. This is an alternative 1970s version of Bakersfield, California.
Yeah.
Well, Keenan, you went to film school in Chicago, watching a lot of B movies from the 1970s by the likes of Roger Corman and Russ Meyer. So obviously, this was a big influence.
Yeah, I mean, that was the starting point for me personally. Was in film school, I wanted to work in genre really bad, and so I was just always constantly trying to think of ideas in genre tropes and in those worlds. And I wanted to do a biker film. And so the script came from that, but I just didn't want to do a biker film. And then I saw the image of a ape, you know, riding on a bike. And then I was like, oh, and they're called the humans, right? Wouldn't that be funny? And then that basically stuck with me for about 15 years, 14 years until I met Tom and told him.
And we kind of became good friends just like over our love of old comics and old B movies.
Yeah,
and like,
trashy movies, comic books.
Like, sit around talking about comics and B movies all the time. And so when the idea came up, I was just like, this is perfect. Let's run with it, you know?
Yeah, I saw this press release. It said, the pages drip with 100% ape biker exploitation at
its
finest.
Yeah, we call it ape-sploitation at this point.
And this is definitely, well, one of the differences between Planet of the Apes and this is that you just go full out on the violence and the sexual explicitness.
So, yes.
So. Sex, drugs, rock and roll, and monkeys, motorcycles.
If you're going to deal with the world of outlaw bikers of any kind, you might as well not pull any punches, and we sure do not when it comes to this comic.
There are callbacks in this book to everything from Moby Dick to Breaking Bad. And yeah, it's funny because I guess Breaking Bad was originally set in Bakersfield before they moved the idea to Albuquerque. So have you had a lot of experience in Bakersfield? Is this just your idea of a place where anything could happen?
That's basically it. I had never been there, but the whole idea was that it's a biker idea and it should be set in Central or Southern California. But we also wanted it to have like a middle of nowhere field, which Bakersfield is basically. And the visuals of like rolling hills, oil derricks, and, you know, a dilapidated city a little bit, like really worked well.
Yeah, it feels a little bit like an Old West and a post-apocalyptic town at the same time. Oildale, like Keenan didn't even know about Oildale.
No.
As soon as he told me about the rival gang, the Scabs, is like, well, they got to be from Oildale. And he was like, oh, Oildale, what's that? He's like, it's the really bad part of town.
Yeah, and I just looked it up that night. I was like, that's exactly what I was writing this town, not knowing it existed. You know, it fit perfectly.
Yeah.
But like you said, it's like where anything can happen. Like, I would feel like in the 70s, biker gangs kind of ruled that town a little bit, too. You know?
Yeah, so, and there's even like some of the old Roger Corman biker films are filmed in that area, too.
Yeah, shot around there.
Yeah, so talk about some of the characters in this, because there's a definite Vietnam flashback, post-traumatic stress disorder subplot going on. And you know, you're using that early 70s troubled vet trope lot in here.
Well, it's the main thing is with the biker culture in America all stems from coming out of wars. Like World War II led to bikers in America in the first place. And then after Vietnam or during Vietnam, that's when there was a huge boom in people trying to grasp the last moments of freedom in America by being on the open road, you know?
Well, and the Hells Angels Motorcycle Club took their name from the B-17 bomber commanders back in World War II.
Exactly.
Vets coming back and not feeling like a part of society, starting their own little clubs of people that made them feel
like creating your own family outside of your biological.
Yeah, I mean, everybody, there is this mythos that in the 40s and 50s, everybody was settling into suburbia, but a lot of vets weren't.
That's like why the wild ones, you know, like but
it's just part of the biker culture in general. So
and when we're dealing with it,
since we decided to set the story in 1970, it made perfect sense that one of them would be coming back there, and he became the central part of the story.
It's like his story and his PTSD and him trying to find his way back into the fold of the humans is the central story of the entire comic. And basically too, like if we're going to look at like films and biker art of that time too, you know, Vietnam War is just intermingled with that. So
there's a lot of absurdism in the book, but obviously you were looking for some serious themes to kind of ground it.
Yeah, we wanted people to care about these characters or why do it. Then like violence and sex are just violence and sex, whereas if you have a character you care about, it's an integral part of the story then. So yeah, we want people to care. We wanted to make a good comic, like well-rounded, big world that's bigger than you even see. You get little hints that it's a larger scope. All those things make it a better comic, I feel like.
Yeah, I think that like works into the whole exploitation cinema kind of thing that we're drawing inspiration from, is like a lot of them were schlocky, over-the-top, violent, and sex-filled movies because that's what got people in the seats. But then they'd have, like, a message behind it of, you know, like, about what's going on. You know, there would be real stories.
Yeah,
they're like art house films of the time.
There's always a social commentary aspect, even if it's done poorly.
Yeah.
It's always in all those films and stuff. So,
but it's also kind of like secondary to just having fun drawing apes.
Yeah.
Apes,
we don't want it to get in the way. We don't want to get that stuff to be in the way at any time, but we want to help it make our world better.
Yeah.
Well, mythologically, you know, a lot of tales that were instructive to various societies would use animals to put the story at kind of a remove.
Right.
So you're not drawing a specific kind of human, but you're taking an animal and giving them human attributes to kind of be able to be more truthful in a way.
Yeah, yeah. And it also like softens the blow of some of the hardcore elements of our comic as well, you know. It allows people to digest it maybe a little bit easier.
Yeah, and then like apes in themselves, I mean, like, as far as like designing the characters and stuff, it was like they're like exaggerated forms of humans.
Yeah,
anyway,
it's like cartooning 101, right?
Ability to like to make the cartooning much more exaggerated and extreme and more fun that way. So I actually enjoyed working with non-human characters more than human characters because you can do that kind of stuff with it.
One of the things that people forget is that in Hollywood, all those movies that involve chimpanzees, they're very cute when they're young, but get a little older, they'll actually tear
bite
your
nose
face
off and rip off your testicles. Yeah.
A legend has it that DC Comics would boost their sales back in the 1960s by putting a monkey on the cover.
Yep, that's an old adage. Put a monkey on the cover and it'll sell.
Yeah.
I wish it was true.
You're listening to Words and Pictures on KBOO. I'm your host, SW Conser. And we're talking today with Tom Neely and Keenan Marshall Keller. They've both been hugely influential in the small press and indie comics world. And now their new project, The Humans, is being published by big time imprint Image Comics. So one of the things that you're doing in the books in each individual comic is you're soliciting letters from skins, and skins are humans. They're the slaves of the apes in the books.
Yeah. Dumb pack,
like
herd animals,
cattle.
Sort of. Yeah, cattle that can hold a broom, basically. Yeah.
Or they also use them for like a human form of dog fighting, like skin fights. So. Yeah, they're like the lower form. They don't really have any intelligence to be able to revolt, like in Planet of the Apes. Like some people early on thought, "Oh, are the actual humans going to revolt?" And I was like, "No,
we don't care about we don't care about the skins in this story as much, you know." So, but
so
yeah,
we got some good letters so far.
Yeah. The back pages, which we can't really say the name of, but is really it's an important part for us because it's what we love about comics. Like we want to have a direct communication with our fans, and we also want to like show them that we have more ideas than just what's even on the page. And by taking notes and having Karns interact with our audience, it's just let people realize that we're doing this for all the right reasons. We're trying to have fun. You
and
know?
Karns is the gnarliest, meanest, grossest character of our gang, so it's fun to like interact with our fans with like the one that will tell you to go F yourself or whatever.
Yeah, he's just vile and mean to everybody, so it's a lot of fun to like write that stuff too, you know?
Yeah.
So speaking of Karns, some of the in-jokes are that names of the characters and locations are a shout-out to some of the people in the comics world.
Yes,
definitely,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, Karns, that's Jason Karns, who Fantagraphics put out a collection of his comic called Fuckator, which is an amazing series, and he's just a cartoonist that we really enjoy. And to be the gnarliest human, he fit perfectly. And then we have Mara is named after Benjamin Mara, who's another Fantagraphics published artist who also self-publishes tons of work. And he's the poet in the gang because Mara's just a pretty boy poet in real life. and then, yeah, like the police officer is named Chief Rugg, and that's after Jim Rugg, who's another artist who's just an amazing person and great artist that we love. And yeah, their roadhouse that they go out and hang out at, the bar, is called Kirby's Roadhouse, and that's obviously to
after
nod
Jack
to
Kirby.
Jack Kirby, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then we have other like shout-outs to our friends in subtle forms, like
background.
The character Nada, who's sort of the hippy-dippy one with the John Lennon glasses. He in every issue, he wears a different T-shirt by a different alternative artist, including like John Porcellino. And
I mean, we did S. Clay Wilson on his shirt.
Nice.
We did one of my old comics on a shirt.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're always trying to give like little nods to friends and
stuff like that. And there's other cameos, like Simon Hanselman and Jack Cohen have a cameo in one of the issues.
They're in the background
in
a scene. And Yeah, we put a lot of the naked skins in the last issue.
Yeah, they're friends of ours
who are like musicians and artists in LA. Tom had to estimate the size of their privates, but I think he did a good job. That's just another thing that's fun for us. And I also like, it gives me a chance to talk about artists I like and care about and should be known better. So that's another reason why to drop them in like that. Any chance I get to talk about Jim Rugg or Benjamin Mara.
And then we had a lot of them do back cover pinups for each issue too, that are all included in the volumes in the backup gallery. But just wanted to like expose.
Spread the love and get these guys seen, you know?
I should mention that you're on a tour of the West Coast, and one of your collaborators who's not here today, Christina Colantis, your colorist, is still back in L.A., I'm assuming.
Yeah.
And she has designed this amazing earth tone 70s color palette for the book that's it sometimes gets pretty psychedelic as well.
That was the idea. We wanted it to be like a muted tone that can then explode, so then those explosions would be even more vivid. And she nailed it. She knew what we were asking for, and she was able to do it really well.
We wanted it to feel like an old comic, but not like a pastiche of old comics. So we definitely wanted like flat colors and like really bright, poppy tones, but like to balance that. Like, to me, in my memory, the 70s is all very orange and brown.
Yeah.
And so like kind of start
there. Army green
then,
and brown.
But then there's lots of psychedelic flashbacks when Johnny starts having his PTSD freakouts and stuff.
And then as the story like builds into the final issues, there's just a lot more vibrant colors too. Because it's all hell is breaking loose.
She's a brilliant illustrator in her own. And so I knew that like she could handle it as soon as she wanted to join the team. It was like, yeah, your color palette's perfect. Especially when we do the psychedelic elements. It's going to be insane.
Just as a personal take on the situation, I appreciate that comics are starting to leave gradients behind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, we don't like that.
For me, coloring is the thing that ruins a comic more than anything else.
Yeah.
I see so many comics that I'm like, oh, that's hideous. Then I see the line work and I'm like, oh, these pages are great. What did they do to this? So we try to, that's something we're very keen on protecting our comics from bad coloring.
To find a replace because Christina's not going to be joining us in the future because she's too good of an illustrator to remain a colorist.
Yeah, she's got her own
work. So she's
work.
Doing her own thing now. But yeah, it's like, yeah, coloring is something that often ruins mainstream comics for me and because there's too many gradients, too much Photoshop tricks, and I'd rather just see
illustrator drop-ins
old school flat colors. Let the drawings live.
Well, Tom, I mean, you know, you're a youngish guy, but you really appreciate old school techniques. You love the loose inks. You love to just spray inks across the page with a brush or a toothbrush or whatever. But you love these techniques that aren't available in the digital realm.
Right.
And
yeah.
So you actually do take these large scale illustration boards and just whip the loose inks across them.
Yeah. I kind of came through into comics through painting. I mean, I grew up always wanting to do comics. And then somewhere in high school, I was like, oh, comics aren't serious art. You should go to art school and learn to be a painter. So I went to school for painting and then realized I hate the fine arts world and wanted to do comics. So I went back into that, but I've always drawn much bigger. I draw like the Humans pages are all on 15 by 20 sheets of watercolor paper. And I use brush and ink on watercolor paper. I hand letter everything because I want each piece, you know, maybe it's the old arrogant art school pretension in me that I want my pages to look like paintings, works of art, you know, so they're all, it's all there and it's all in one piece. And I prefer using the older techniques of like, you know, hand lettering and ink and brush on a page is much more satisfying to me than digital work. There's some brilliant digital artists out there. I'm getting more into that. I mean, Christina is one herself, but yeah, for me, it's got to be old school.
Other than coloring, something that ruins comics for me, too, is seeing like a great drawing with dropped in digital lettering. You know, so that's like, to me, it's important working with Tom that like the fact that he does all of that is what makes our comic that much better. In my eyes, that's why I enjoy working with him, too. It's like the hand lettering. It's a part of drawing, too.
Yeah.
You know, it's a part of the page and it should be. So
I think
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like dropping a drum machine into an orchestra in a way.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Having a font all of a sudden dropped in.
And some people can be brilliant at it, but for the most part, I don't know.
Well, speaking of old school technology, you have a soundtrack that you've included in some of this, in some of the packaging. Limited edition 7-inch vinyl record.
Yeah, we also released songs with every issue. We had like 2 to 3 new songs that were on a SoundCloud. They're actually all free on our SoundCloud right
now.
Yeah,
we have a the human soundtrack
on
SoundCloud.
You sort of invented a band, is that right?
There's one invented band that lives in the comic, but it's a real
But it's a real musician that made the music for us.
Yeah, but he's in Secret Identity.
But then all the other bands we worked with are real bands that, for the most part, 85% of them wrote songs for the comic for our soundtrack.
I'm reminded of what Damon Albarn and Jamie Hewlett did with Gorillaz.
But yeah, we just like, that's something we always wanted to do. My second graphic novel, The Wolf, was originally going to be a graphic novel with a record soundtrack, but the musician on that project dropped out. And he's, you know,
I've
his
done
wife
zines
is in a band
with,
and he's done
with
a lot
soundtracks
of
already. And yeah, my wife's a punk rock drummer. So
as soon as we started doing it, we're like, well, we should do this. Let's do a soundtrack. Because like biker movie soundtracks.
Yeah, soundtrack is an important part of the genre too. So we felt like it was a necessary thing. And so we did the digital. With every issue, we had two or three songs up that would correlate kind of with that issue. And then we also did put out two different 7-inches with bands.
Right.
And we have a third one still coming out later this year.
And hopefully an LP eventually.
Yeah, and at one point we'll collect all the SoundCloud stuff. Stuff and
but right
make
now
a record.
It's all on our SoundCloud. Go Google The Human Soundtrack SoundCloud,
and
there's
23 songs
wow. for free. So.
Yeah, and Keenan, you've definitely been part of the LA scene for a long time. Yeah, you've worked in the music world, you've worked in the art world, you've put on some shows.
Yeah.
There's a publishing project, Drippy Bone Books, that's based in LA, Denver, and Amsterdam.
Yeah, it's basically been me for the last couple years, but my partners that started it, they were living in Denver and Amsterdam. I was part of a gallery in LA for a year and a half too, where we put on art shows, and I've curated shows for the past 10 years in LA off and on. Music and art go hand to hand with me. And, I always, before I started doing comics hard, I was trying to find what to do in the art world that would make me feel like I was accomplishing something, you know. And it wasn't until I started really focusing on comics that I felt like I was doing the thing I always wanted to do. So
Art Spiegelman years and years ago used to complain about losing some of his best comics artists to rock and roll.
Yeah.
That can happen sometimes. Yeah.
And you're the writer
yes.
on The Humans, but you've been an artist and put out your own series of comics, Galactic Breakdown, which
yeah.
was dedicated to Tammy Faye. It wasn't so much the content of the shows that Tammy Faye hosted. It was more like the crazy color scheme, right?
Well, my cat was named Tammy Faye as well, but I also do love Tammy Faye Baker as a person. I think she was actually a really remarkable. She found
fascinating.
She found light after everything that happened to her with the horrible church and her husband. She became a much better person through that process. And when she had cancer, she became a really amazing person, very strong speaker for gay rights and everything.
There's,
you know,
quite a
Jim J. Bullock was like her best.
Was it the eyes of Tammy Faye?
Yeah. And that's why our cat was named Tammy Faye, because she had black eyes. So it was like the makeup smearing around her eyes. So I was basically dedicated to my cat, but also my cat's named after Tammy Faye because I love Tammy Faye. So.
And so Galactic Breakdown was just kind of this. Yeah, it was very punk. It had the type of characters you might see in L.A., some steroidal characters.
It's basically about a steroids dealer who gets shot into space and becomes an intergalactic warrior. And it's even dumber than that description entails. It's just day-glow, colorful, violent, and goofy. Violent glee is how I describe it a lot of time. But it was my first comic I ever drew when I was... I don't know, it was like 30 or something.
It's an insane drug-fueled space opera.
Yeah, yeah. It's how I got to meet a lot of cartoonists, you know? Like,
yeah.
Nobody bought my comic, but it seems like cartoonists like it.
The first time I remember being at Secret Headquarters comic shop in L.A. for somebody's signing, and I was talking to Johnny Ryan, and we both, like, gravitated towards the cover for Galactic Breakdown number one, and we're like, fought over it. And we're like, what is this? We need this. And I think Johnny, like, went home that night and did, like, a tribute to your cover. And like,
yeah, yeah. He did the covered on that covered blog before it was shut down. And
so that's when we first
more people
met him.
Saw that than bought the comic ever, for sure.
So the two of you, Keenan and Tom, you were mutual admirers years before you actually met.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, when I met, I didn't really know of his work until I met him. But the moment I saw his table, I was like, oh, we should hang out, dude. Like,
yeah.
Henry and Glenn Forever, and then his book of comic poetry that was like 4-frame comics.
Mm-hmm.
This long landscape printing on it, like the book was really great, and the blot, I was just like, oh man, this guy actually is taking himself seriously and doing good work, you know.
Yeah, and we met at this tiny little comic festival in like El
Segundo.
Possibly
the worst we've ever done.
but then we realized we lived like a mile from each other, like almost in the same neighborhood, and started hanging out talking comics all the time. And
And then we found out
3 years later, we ended up putting the humans together. So
yeah, and Tom, one of the projects I really enjoyed of yours was you would take old B-movie posters and make them even creepier and crazier.
Right, yeah, I did that. A lot of like old horror comics and horror posters. I did that art show up here in at the Grass Hat Gallery in Portland. I think that was like 2010, maybe. But yeah, I had a whole show of those. And those were like a lot of fun to do. That was just kind of like my love of old horror comics and horror in general. Is like I want to pay tribute to some of these old artists by doing my own versions of their work.
And yeah, considering how scary and creepy and hideous some of your illustrations were, it's kind of interesting that one of your recent projects was actually you got called in by Roger Langridge at IDW Idea and Design Works to sort of help kickstart the Popeye comic again.
Yeah, and that kind of came about in a roundabout way where I had done my own bootleg parody Popeye mini comic called Doppelganger, which is basically where Popeye smokes some drugs and has an existential crisis and beats himself up for like 15 pages. And I've done that because
actually it's kind of like Dada-esque. It's very surrealistically beautiful.
Definitely. Totally. I mean, like most of my earlier work is steeped in surrealism. That's what I'm really interested in personally. And the ideas of like doppelgangers and like goes back to like, I mean, everything from Rene Magritte to like David Cronenberg, like influencing that.
Oh yeah,
that
body
work.
Horror.
So, yeah. So I'd done this like just weird Popeye existential nightmare comic and had given that to Craig Yeo at some point. And he was the editor of that new Popeye series. And I'd known Roger Langridge through some of the indie shows. Like I met him at SPX like 10 years ago and we'd always kept in touch. So when I got the opportunity, at first they had another artist, but then they called me in as a backup when they were getting behind schedule. And I got to do two short stories starring the backup characters Sapo and Dr. Wattis Nozzle. And then I got to do one full issue, the issue number 3 of Popeye, where Wimpy is in a boxing match against the Phantom Crusher. And it was a super fun job to have. I've got Popeye anchors tattooed on my arms.
That's right.
I'm like a huge Popeye fan.
And yeah, you had your forearms covered up here, but I can attest to the radio listeners that there are indeed anchors on each of your forearms.
Mm-hmm. So it was like a dream job to get that at first. It didn't work out that I couldn't stay on the series, but it was great to get to be a part of it.
Your style was definitely a callback to the 1930s, and it really was. Thimble mm-hmm. Theater really was kind of a surrealist adventure series. E.C. Seeger right. was the original artist, and it was that was very different from the sort of King Features Harvey comic style that came much later.
Right, yeah, and those early E.C. Seegers were a big influence on me early on, and that's what led me to my... It was a big influence on my first graphic novel, The Blot. It was definitely going for like trying to draw a 30s style comic strip, kind of, but it was also a surrealistic graphic novel about a guy plagued by a giant blot of ink. So, but the style of drawing was very much influenced by E.C. Seeger and even the early Fleischer Popeye cartoons, and then, you know, a bunch of other oddballs that I love from that era.
So I guess I should ask what's coming up next. The Humans was originally intended to be a limited miniseries, and
right.
It sounds like you're being pretty successful. Are you going to keep on working on this series? Are you looking to collaborate on a new series together?
Yeah, both. A little bit of both.
Yeah.
Immediately we're working on a Christmas issue for The Humans that'll come out later this year, just as a one-shot. And then
we have multiple arcs for continuing The Humans, but before we do the next arc called The Jungle, we are going to be hopefully doing a separate idea together, collaborating on something that's not in The Humans world, just because we want to try to do as many things as we can and get our voice and our ideas out there.
Yeah.
So we have a couple things that we'll be pitching to Image here very shortly, and hopefully they'll bite and we'll just get working on it, you know?
We're working on possibly a horror comedy. Mini series that we want to do.
Splatter gore road trip about grave robbers.
So that should be fun to draw.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I want to like, you know, sink back into my love of old horror and like EC
creepy
comics
and eerie
and creepy and eerie and kind of like, it'll be black and white and lots of gray tones. It'll be a lot of fun to draw. It's a different kind of, because I always like to change up my style when I do a new book, is like try something new to challenge myself. And So it'll be fun to try that.
Now, Creepy was restarted by, was it Dark Horse?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're doing Eerie and Creepy, right?
Right. And yeah. we actually did something for Eerie
last
year.
We did a page. Tom did a page, and I wrote like five sentences
in it. Krampus, really? Oh, no wonder you're doing a Christmas special.
Yeah, that was for the Eerie Christmas special. We did a. They asked me to do a Krampus for them, so.
Krampus being the Bavarian helper of Santa who drags children away in his
Takes
sack.
The kids.
Naughty children, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Eats them.
So for our listeners who might be interested in your other projects, how can they find out more? I know, Tom, your site is iwilldestroyyou.com.
Yeah, I sadly haven't updated it in too long, but I think Christina is working on updating that for me right now as we speak. She's sort of my web person as well. But yeah, iwilldestroyyou.com is my website. Also, we have humansforlife.com is our humans
it's
website.
It's our human site. It's got all of our info in our store on there. And I don't have any information for Drippy Moon Books anymore. You have to just contact me directly if you want anything. I sell them direct now. I don't have a website at the moment.
Yeah, and I'm an Instagram abuser at iwilldestroyyou.com. So I'm on there like all the time. And when I'm working on a project, I post a lot of like in-progress shots and stuff so people can see me drawing if they like. And also, the Henry and Glenn Forever and Forever and Ever books are available through Microcosm Publishing.
Well, the book is The Humans, Humans for Life. It's published by Image Comics. The writer is Keenan Marshall Keller. The art is by Tom Neely, and the colors are by Christina Kalantis. Keenan and Tom, it's been great to have you here today on Words and Pictures.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
Appreciate it. Go buy our comic.
Yes. Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. I'm your host, SW Conser. You can find an archived version of this show later today at KBOO.FM/Words and Pictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Words and Picture. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station.